Goldfinger by Ian Fleming, continued. Disc 7.
Later, when they had got to the problem of transporting the tons of gold out of the town, Bond had had one last try. He said, "Goldfinger, you're not going to get this stuff away. Nobody's going to get their 100 tons of gold out of the place, let alone 500. You'll find yourself tearing down the Dixie Highway in a truck with a few gold bars loaded with gamma rays and the American army on your tail, and you'll have killed 60,000 people for that. The thing's farcical. Even if you do get a ton or two away, where the hell do you think you're going to hide it?"
"Mr. Bond,"
Goldfinger's patience was infinite,
"it just happens that a Soviet cruiser of the Sverdlovsk class will be visiting Norfolk, Virginia, on a goodwill cruise at that time. It sails from Norfolk on D+1. Initially by train, and then by transporter convoy, my gold will arrive on board the cruiser by midnight on D-Day. I shall sail in the cruiser for Kronstadt. Everything has been carefully planned. Every possible hitch has been foreseen. I have lived with this operation for 5 years. Now the time has come for the performance. I have tidied up my activities in England and Europe. Such small debris as remains of my former life can go to the scavengers, who will shortly be sniffing on my trail. I shall be gone. I shall have emigrated, and, Mr. Bond, I shall have taken the golden heart of America with me. Naturally,"
Goldfinger was indulgent,
"this unique performance will not be immaculate. There has not been enough time for rehearsals. I need these clumsy gangsters with their guns and their men, but I could not bring them into the plan until the last moment. They will make mistakes. Conceivably, they will have much trouble getting their own loot away. Some will be caught, others killed. I couldn't care less. These men are amateurs who were needed, so to speak, for the crowd scenes. They are extras, Mr. Bond, brought in off the streets. What happens to them after the play is of no interest to me whatsoever. And now, on with the work. I shall need 7 copies of all this by nightfall. Where were we?"
So in fact, reflected Bond feverishly, this was not only a Goldfinger operation with Smersh in the background. Smersh had even got the High Presidium to play. This was Russia versus America, with Goldfinger as the spearhead. Was it an act of war to steal something from another country? But who would know that Russia had the gold? No one, if the plan went off as Goldfinger intended. None of the gangsters had an inkling. To them, Goldfinger was just another of them, another gangster, slightly larger than life-size. And Goldfinger's staff, his drivers for the golden convoy to the coast, Bond himself and Tilly Masterton. Some would be killed, including him and the girl. Some, the Koreans, for instance, would no doubt sail in the cruiser. Not a trace would be left, not a witness. It was modern piracy with all the old-time trimmings. Goldfinger was sacking Fort Knox as Bloody Morgan had sacked Panama. There was no difference except that the weapons and the techniques had been brought up to date, and there was only one man in the whole world who could stop it. But how? The next day was an unending blizzard of paperwork. Every half-hour a note would come in from Goldfinger's operations room, asking for schedules of this, copies of that, estimates, timetables, lists of stores. Another typewriter was brought in, maps, reference books, anything that Bond requisitioned. But not once did Odd Job relax the extreme care with which he opened the door to Bond's knock. Not once did his watchful eyes wander from Bond's eyes, hands, feet, when he came into the room to bring meals or notes or supplies. There was no question of Bond and the girl being part of the team. They were dangerous slaves, and nothing else. Tilly Masterton was equally reserved. She worked like a machine, quick, willing, accurate, but uncommunicative. She responded with cool politeness to Bond's early attempts to make friends, share his thoughts with her. By the evening he had learnt nothing about her except that she had been a successful amateur ice skater in between secretarial work for Unilevers. Then she had started getting star parts in ice shows. Her hobby had been indoor pistol and rifle shooting, and she had belonged to 2 marksman clubs. She had few friends. She had never been in love or engaged. She lived by herself in 2 rooms in Earl's Court. She was 24. Yes, She realized that they were in a bad fix, but something would turn up. This Fort Knox business was nonsense. It would certainly go wrong. She thought Miss Pussy Galore was divine. She somehow seemed to count on her to get her out of this mess. Women, with a sniff, were rather good at things that needed finesse. Instinct told them what to do. Bond was not to worry about her. She would be all right. Bond came to the conclusion that Tilly Masterton was one of those girls whose hormones had got mixed up. He knew the type well, and thought they and their male counterparts were a direct consequence of giving votes to women and sex equality. As a result of 50 years of emancipation, feminine qualities were dying out or being transferred to the males. Pansies of both sexes were everywhere, not yet completely homosexual, but confused, not knowing what they were. The result was a herd of unhappy sexual misfits, barren and full of frustrations, the women wanting to dominate and the men to be nannied. He was sorry for them, but he had no time for them. Bond smiled sourly to himself as he remembered his fantasies about this girl as they sped along the valley of the Loire. Entre deux Seines, indeed. At the end of the day, there was a final note from Goldfinger.
5 principals and myself will leave LaGuardia Airport tomorrow at 11 a.m. in chartered plane, flown by my pilots for aerial survey of Grand Slam. You will accompany. Masterton will remain. G.
Bond sat on the edge of his bed and looked at the wall. Then he got up and went to the typewriter. He worked for an hour, typing, single-spaced on both sides of the sheet, exact details of the operation. He folded the sheet, rolled it to a small cylinder about the size of his little finger, and sealed it carefully with gum. Next, he typed on a slip of paper, "Urgent and vital. Reward of $5,000 is guaranteed with no questions asked to the finder who delivers this message unopened to Felix Leiter, care Pinkerton's Detective Agency, 154 Nassau Street, New York City. Immediate cash on delivery." Bond rolled this message round the cylinder, wrote $5,000 reward in red ink on the outside, and stuck the little package down the center of 3 inches of scotch tape. Then he sat down again on the edge of the bed, and carefully strapped the free ends of the scotch tape down the inside of his thigh. Chapter 20. Journey into Holocaust.
"Mister, flying control is buzzing us. Wants to know who we are. They say this is restricted air."
Goldfinger got up from his seat and went forward into the cockpit. Bond watched him pick up the hand microphone. His voice came back clearly over the quiet hum of the 10-seater executive Beechcraft.
"Good morning! This is Mr. Gold of Paramount Pictures Corporation. We are carrying out an authorized survey of the territory for a forthcoming A picture of the famous Confederate raid of 1861, which resulted in the capture of General Sherman at Muldrow Hill. Yes, that's right. Cary Grant and Elizabeth Taylor in the lead. What's that? Clearance? Sure, we've got clearance. Let me see now."
Goldfinger consulted nothing.
"Yes, here it is, signed by Chief of Special Services at the Pentagon. Sure, the commanding officer at the Armored Center will have a copy. Okay, and thanks. Hope you'll enjoy the picture. Bye."
Goldfinger wiped the breezy expression off his face, handed over the microphone, and came back into the cabin. He braced his legs and stood looking down at his passengers.
"Well, gentlemen and madam, do you think you've seen enough? I think you'll agree it's all pretty clear and conforms with your copies of the town plan. I don't want to go much lower than 6,000. Perhaps we could make one more circuit and be off. Odd job, get out the refreshments."
There was a mumble of comment and questions, which Goldfinger dealt with one by one. Odd job got up from Bond's side and walked down to the rear. Bond followed him and, under his hard, suspicious stare, went into the little lavatory and locked the door. He sat down calmly and thought. There hadn't been a chance on the way down to LaGuardia. He had sat with Oddjob in the back of an unobtrusive Buick saloon. The doors had been locked on them by the driver and the windows tightly closed. Goldfinger had ridden in front, the partition closed behind him. Oddjob had sat slightly sideways, his horn-ridged hands held ready on his thighs like heavy tools. He had not taken his eyes off Bond until the car had driven round the boundary to the charter hangars and come up alongside the private plane. Sandwiched between Goldfinger and Oddjob, Bond had had no alternative but to climb up the steps into the plane and take his seat with Oddjob beside him. 10 minutes later, the others had arrived. There was no communication with them except an exchange of curt greetings. They were all different now. No smart remarks, no unnecessary talk. These were men who had gone to war. Even Pussy Galore, in a black Dacron Macintosh with a black leather belt, looked like some young SS guardsman. Once or twice in the plane she had turned and looked at Bond rather thoughtfully, but she hadn't answered his smile. Perhaps she just couldn't understand where Bond fitted in, who he was. When they got back to LaGuardia, there would be the same routine. It was now or never. But where? Among the leaves of lavatory paper? But they might be disturbed too soon, or not for weeks. Would the ashtray be emptied? Possibly not. But one thing would. There was a rattle at the door handle. Oddjob was getting restless. Perhaps Bond was setting fire to the plane. Bond called, "Coming, ape!" He got up and lifted the seat. He tore the little package off the inside of his thigh and transferred it to the underside of the foredge of the seat. The seat would have to be lifted to get at the Elsan, and that would certainly be looked to as soon as the plane got back to the hangar. The $5,000 reward stared back at him boldly. Not even the most hasty cleaner could miss it, so long as no one preceded the cleaner. But Bond didn't think any of the passengers would lift the seat. The little compartment was too cramped to stand comfortably in. He softly put the seat down, ran some water in the basin, washed his face and smoothed his hair, and walked out. Oddjob was waiting angrily. He pushed past Bond, looked carefully round the lavatory, and came out again, shutting the door. Bond walked back to his seat. Now the SOS was in the bottle, and the bottle had been committed to the waves. Who would be the finder? How soon? Everyone, down to the pilot and co-pilot, went to the blasted little lavatory before they got back on the ground. As each one came out, Bond expected to feel the cold nose of a gun in his neck, the harsh, suspicious words, the crackle of the paper being unfolded. But at last they were back in the Buick and speeding over the Triborough into uptown Manhattan, and then down the river on the parkway and in through the well-guarded doors of the warehouse, and back to work. Now it was a race. A race between Goldfinger's calm, unhurried, efficient machine and the tiny gunpowder trail Bond had lit. What was going on outside? During every hour of the next 3 days, Bond's imagination followed what might be happening. Leiter telling his chief, the conference, the quick flight down to Washington, the FBI and Hoover, the Army, the President. Leiter insisted that Bond's conditions be adhered to, that no suspicious moves be made, no inquiries started, that no one moved an inch except according to some master plan that would operate on the day and get the whole gang into the bag so that not one of them escaped. Would they accept Bond's conditions, or would they not dare take the chance? Had they talked across the Atlantic with M? Had M insisted that Bond should be somehow pulled out? No, M would see the point. He would agree that Bond's life must be disregarded, that nothing must jeopardize the big clean-up. They would have to get the two Japanese, of course, somehow beat out of them the code message Goldfinger would be waiting for on D-1. Was that how it was going? Or was it all a shambles? Leiter away on another assignment. Who is this 007? What does it stand for? Some crazy loon. Hi, Smith, check on this, could you? Get down to the warehouse and take a look. Sorry, mister, no $5,000 for you. Here's carfare, back to LaGuardia. Afraid you've been hoaxed. Or, worse still, had none of these things happened? Was the plane still standing in a corner of the field, unserviced? Night and day the torment of thoughts went through Bond's head, while the work got cleared and the hours ticked by and the deadly machine whirred quietly on. D-1 came and flashed by in a last fever of activity. Then in the evening came the note from Goldfinger.
First phase of operation successful. Entrain as planned at midnight. Bring copies of all maps, schedules, operation orders. G.
In close formation with Bond and Tilly Masterton, he in a white surgeon's coat, she dressed as a nurse, wedged in the middle, the Goldfinger contingent marched swiftly through the almost empty concourse of Pennsylvania Station and down to the waiting special. Everyone, including Goldfinger, was wearing the conventional white garb and armbands of a medical field force, and the dim platform was crowded with the ghostly waiting figures of the posses from the gangs. The silence and tension was appropriate for an emergency force hurrying to the scene of a disaster, and the stretcher and decontamination suits being loaded into the compartments added drama to the scene. The superintendent was talking quietly with the senior physicians in the shape of Midnight, Strap, Solo, and Ring. Nearby stood Miss Galore, with a dozen pale-faced nurses who waited with eyes bent, as if they stood beside an open grave. Without makeup, their exotic hairdos tucked into dark blue Red Cross caps, they had been well rehearsed. They were giving an excellent performance, dutiful, merciful, dedicated to the relief of human suffering. When the superintendent saw Goldfinger and his party approaching, he hurried up.
"Dr. Gold?"
His face was grave. "I'm afraid the news coming through isn't too good. Guess it'll all be in the papers tonight. All trains held at Louisville. No reply from the depot at Fort Knox. But we'll get you through, all right. God almighty, Doctor, what's going on down there? People coming through from Louisville are talking about the Russians spraying something from the air." "Of course." The superintendent looked keenly at Goldfinger. "I'm not believing that kind of stuff. But what is it? Food poisoning?" Goldfinger's face was solemn. He said in a kindly voice,
"My friend, that's what we've got to find out. That's why we're being rushed down. If you want me to make a guess, but mark you, it's only a guess, it's a form of sleeping sickness. Trypanosomiasis, we call it."
"That so?" The superintendent was impressed by the sound of the malady. "Well, believe you me, Doctor, we're almighty proud of you and your folks of the emergency force." He held out his hand. Goldfinger took it. "Best of luck, Doc. And now, if you'll get your men and the nurses on board, I'll have this train on its way just as quick as may be."
"Thank you, Superintendent. My colleagues and I will not forget your services."
Goldfinger gave a short bow. His contingent moved on.
"Board!"
Bond found himself in a Pullman with Tilly Masterton across the aisle and the Koreans and Germans all around them. Goldfinger was in the front of the car talking cheerfully with his satraps. Miss Pussy Galore strolled by. She ignored the upturned face of Tilly Masterton, but gave Bond the usual searching glance. There was a banging of doors being closed. Pussy Galore stopped and rested an arm on the back of the seat in front of Bond. She looked down at him.
"Hello, handsome. Long time no see. Uncle doesn't seem to let you off the lead much."
Bond said, "Hello, beautiful. That outfit suits you fine. I'm feeling rather faint. How about doing a bit of nursing?" The deep violet eyes examined him carefully. She said softly,
"You know what, Mr. Bond? I got a feeling there's something phony about you. I got instincts, see? Just what are you and that doll," she jerked her head back, "doing in this outfit?"
"We do all the work." The train began to move. Pussy Galore straightened herself. She said,
"Maybe you do. But if any little thing goes wrong with this caper, for my money it'll be Handsome who knows why. Get me?"
She didn't wait for Bond's answer, but moved on down and joined the chiefs of staff meeting. It was a confused, busy night. Appearances had to be kept up before the inquisitive, sympathetic eyes of the conductors. Last-minute conferences up and down the train had to wear the appearance of serious medical conclaves. No cigar smoking, no swearing, no spitting. Jealousies and competition between the gangs had to be kept under rigid control. The cold superiority of the Mafia, particularly vis-à-vis Jack Strap and his soft, easy-living crowd from the West, might have led to gunplay if the chiefs hadn't been ready for trouble and constantly on the lookout for it. All these minor psychological factors had been foreseen by Goldfinger and prepared for. The women from the cement mixers were carefully segregated. There was no drinking, and the gang chiefs kept their men occupied with further exact briefings, dummy exercises with maps, and lengthy discussions about their escape plans with the gold. There was casual spying on each other's plans, and Goldfinger was often called in to judge who should have which routes to the Mexican border, to the desert, to Canada. To Bond it was amazing that 100 of the toughest crooks in America, on edge with excitement and greed, could be kept as quiet as they were. It was Goldfinger who had achieved the miracle. Apart from the calm, dangerous quality of the man, it was the minuteness of the planning and the confidence he exuded that calmed the battle nerves and created some sort of a team spirit among the rival mobs. As the iron gallop of the train stretched itself out through the flatlands of Pennsylvania, gradually the passengers fell into an uneasy, troubled sleep. But not Goldfinger, or Oddjob. They remained awake and watchful, and soon Bond gave up any idea he might have had of using one of his hidden knives on Odd Job and making a bid for freedom when the train slowed through a station or on an up gradient. Bond dozed fitfully, wondering, imagining, puzzling over the superintendent's words. The superintendent had certainly thought they were the truth, knew that Fort Knox was in emergency. Was his news from Louisville the truth, or part of the giant cover plan that would be necessary to get every member of the conspiracy in the bag? If it was a cover plan, how meticulously had it been prepared? Would someone slip up? Would there be some ghastly bungle that would warn Goldfinger in time? Or if the news was true, if the poison had been successful, what did there remain for Bond to do? Bond had made up his mind on one score. Somehow, in the excitement of HR, he would get close to Goldfinger and cut his throat with one of his hidden knives. How much would that achieve, apart from an act of private vengeance? Would Goldfinger's squad accept another man's order to arm the warhead and fire it? Who would be strong enough, cool enough to take over? Mr. Solo? Probably. The operation would perhaps be half successful. They would get away with plenty of gold, except Goldfinger's men, who would be lost without him to lead them. And in the meantime, whatever else Bond could now do, had 60,000 people already died. Was there anything he could have done to prevent that? Had there ever been a chance to kill Goldfinger? Would it have done any good to make a scene at Pennsylvania Station? Bond stared at his dark reflection in the window, listened to the sweet ting of the grade crossing bells, and the howl of the windhorn clearing their way, and shredded his nerves with doubts, questions, reproaches.
Chapter 21. The Richest Man in History. Slowly the red dawn broke over the endless plain of black grass that gradually turned to the famous Kentucky blue, as the sun ironed out the shadows. At 6 o'clock the train began to slacken speed, and soon they were gliding gently through the waking suburbs of Louisville to come to rest with a sigh of hydraulics in the echoing, almost deserted station. A small, respectful group was awaiting them. Goldfinger, his eyes black-ringed with lack of sleep, beckoned to one of the Germans, picked up his authoritative little black bag, and stepped down onto the platform. There was a short, serious conclave, the Louisville superintendent doing the talking, and Goldfinger interjecting a few questions and nodding gravely at the answers. Goldfinger turned wearily back to the train. Mr. Solo had been deputed to take his report. He stood at the open door at the end of the Pullman. Bond heard Goldfinger say sorrowfully,
"I am afraid, Doctor, the situation is as bad as we feared. I will now go forward to the leading diesel with this." He held up the black bag, "and we will proceed slowly into the infected area. Would you please tell all personnel to be prepared to put on their masks? I have masks for the driver and fireman. All other railway personnel will leave the train here."
Mr. Solo nodded solemnly.
"Right, Professor."
He closed his door. Goldfinger walked off down the platform, followed by his German strong-arm man and the respectful head-shaking group. There was a short pause, and then silently, almost reverently, the long train whispered its way out of the station, leaving the little group of officials, now reinforced by 4 rather shame-faced conductors, with hands raised in benediction. 35 miles, half an hour to go. Coffee and doughnuts were brought round by the nurses, and Goldfinger thought of everything, for those whose nerves needed it, 2 grains of dexedrine. The nurses were pale, silent. There were no jokes, no smart remarks. The train was electric with tension. After 10 minutes there was a sudden slackening of speed and a sharp hiss from the brakes. Coffee was spilled. The train almost stopped. Then there was a jerk and it gathered speed again. A new hand had taken over on the dead man's handle. A few minutes later Mr. Strap came hurrying through the train.
10 minutes to go. On your toes, folks. Squads A, B, and C get their equipment on. Everything's going fine. Stay calm. Remember your duties.
He hurried through to the next compartment, and Bond heard the voice repeating its message. Bond turned to Oddjob.
"Listen, you ape. I'm going to the lavatory, and probably Miss Masterton will, too."
He turned to the girl.
"What about it, Tilly?"
"Yes," she said indifferently. "I suppose I'd better."
Bond said, "Well, go ahead."
The Korean beside the girl looked inquiringly at Oddjob. Oddjob shook his head.
Bond said, "Unless you leave her alone, I'm going to start a fight. Goldfinger won't like that." He turned to the girl. "Go ahead, Tilly. I'll see to these apes." Oddjob uttered a series of barks and snarls, which the other Korean seemed to understand. The guard got up and said,
"Okay, but not locking the door."
He followed the girl down the Pullman and stood and waited for her to come out. Oddjob carried out the same routine with Bond. Once inside, Bond took off his right shoe, slid out the knife, and slipped it down inside the waistband of his trousers. One shoe would now have no heel, but no one was going to notice that this morning. Bond washed himself. The face in the mirror was pale, and the blue-grey eyes dark with tension. He went out and back to his seat. Now there was a distant shimmer away to the right, and a hint of low buildings rising like a mirage in the early morning ground mist. They slowly defined themselves as hangars with a squat control tower, Godman Field. The soft, pounding howl of the train slackened. Some trim, modern villas, part of a new housing development, slid by. They seemed to be unoccupied. Now, on the left, there was the black ribbon of Brandenburg Station Road. Bond craned. The gleaming, modern sprawl of Fort Knox looked almost soft in the light mist. Above its jagged outline, the air was clear as crystal, not a trace of smoke. No breakfasts cooking. The train slowed to a canter. On Station Road there had been a bad motor accident. Two cars seemed to have met head-on. The body of a man sprawled half out of a smashed door. The other car lay on its back like a dead beetle. Bond's heart pounded. The main signal box came and went. Over the levers something white was draped. It was a man's shirt. Inside the shirt, the body hung down, its head below the level of the window. A row of modern bungalows. A body clad in singlet and trousers flat on its face in the middle of a trim lawn. The lines of mown grass were beautifully exact until, near the man, the mower had written an ugly flourish and had then come to rest on its side in the newly turned earth of the border. A line of washing that had broken when the woman had grasped it. The woman lay in a white pile at one end of the sagging string of family underclothes, cloths and towels. And now the train was moving at walking pace into the town, and everywhere, down every street, on every sidewalk, there were the sprawling figures, singly, in clumps, in rocking chairs, on the porches, in the middle of intersections where the traffic lights still unhurriedly ticked off their coloured signals, in cars that had managed to pull up, and in others that had smashed into shop windows. Death. Dead people everywhere. No movement, no sound save the click of the murderer's iron feet as his train slid through the graveyard. Now there was bustle in the carriages. Billy Ring came through, grinning hugely. He stopped by Bond's chair.
"Oh, boy," he said delightedly. "Old Goldie certainly slipped down to Mickey Finn. Too bad some people are out for a ride when they got hit. But you know what they say about omelets? You can't make 'em without you break some eggs, right?"
Bond smiled tightly. "That's right." Billy Ring made his silent O of a laugh and went on his way. The train trundled through Brandenburg Station. Now there were scores of bodies, men, women, children, soldiers. The platform was scribbled with them, faces upwards to the roof, down in the dust, cradled sideways. Bond searched for movement, for an inquisitive eye, for a twitching hand. Nothing. Wait, what was that? Thinly through the closed window there came a soft, mewing wail. Three perambulators stood against the ticket office. The mothers collapsed beside them. Of course, the babies in the perambulators would have drunk milk, not the deadly water. Oddjob got to his feet. So did the whole of Goldfinger's team. The faces of the Koreans were indifferent, unchanged. Only their eyes flickered constantly like nervous animals. The Germans were pale, grim. Nobody looked at anyone else. Silently they filed towards the exit and lined up, waiting. Tilly Masterton touched Bond's sleeve. Her voice trembled.
"Are you sure they're only asleep? I thought I saw some sort of froth on some of the lips."
Bond had seen the same thing. The froth had been pink. He said, "I expect some of them were eating sweets or something when they fell asleep. You know what these Americans are? Always chewing something." He softly mouthed the next words. "Stay away from me. There may be shooting." He looked hard at her to see she understood. She nodded dumbly, not looking at him. She whispered out of the corner of her mouth,
"I'm going to get near Pussy. She'll look after me."
Bond gave her a smile and said, "Good," encouragingly. The train clicked slowly over some points and slid to rest. There came one blast of the diesel's windhorn. The doors swung open and the different groups piled out onto the platform of the bullion depository siding. Now everything went with military precision. The various squads formed up in their battle order. First an assault group with submachine guns, then the stretcher-bearers to get the guard and other personnel out of the vault. Surely an unnecessary refinement now, thought Bond. Then Goldfinger's demolition team, 10 men with their bulky tarpaulin-covered package, then a mixed group of spare drivers and traffic control men, then the group of nurses, now all armed with pistols, who were to stay in the background with a heavily armed reserve group that was to deal with any unexpected interference from anybody who, as Goldfinger had put it, might wake up. Bond and the girl had been included in the command group, which consisted of Goldfinger, Oddjob, and the 5 gang leaders. They were to be stationed on the flat roofs of the 2 diesel locomotives, which now stood, as planned, beyond the siding buildings and in full view of the objective and its approaches. Bond and the girl were to handle the maps, the timetables, and the stopwatch, and Bond was to watch out for fumbles and delays and bring them at once to Goldfinger's attention to be rectified by walkie-talkie with the squad leaders. When the bomb was due to be fired, they would take shelter behind the diesels. There came a double blast from the windhorn, and as Bond and the girl climbed to their position on the roof of the 1st diesel, the assault squad, followed by the other sections, doubled across the 20 yards of open ground between the railway and Bullion Boulevard. Bond edged as close as he could to Goldfinger. Goldfinger had binoculars to his eyes. His mouth was close to the microphone strapped to his chest. But Oddjob stood between them, a solid mountain of flesh, and his eyes, uninterested in the drama of the assault, never flickered from Bond and the girl. Bond, under cover of scanning his plastic map case and keeping an eye on the stopwatch, measured inches and angles. He glanced at the next-door group of the 4 men and the woman. They were gazing in frozen attention at the scene before them. Now Jack Strap said excitedly, "They're through the 1st gates!" Bond, putting half his mind to work on his own plans, took a quick look at the battlefield. It was an extraordinary scene. In the centre stood the huge, squat mausoleum, the sun glinting off the polished granite of its walls. Outside the big open field in which it stood, the roads, the Dixie Highway, Vine Grove and Bullion Boulevard, were lined with trucks and transporters 2 deep with the recognition flags of the gangs flying from the 1st and last vehicle of each convoy. Their drivers lay piled up outside the shelter of the surrounding guard wall of the vault, while, through the main gate, poured the tidy, disciplined squads from the train. Outside this world of movement, there was absolute stillness and silence, as if the rest of America was holding its breath at the committal of this gigantic crime. And outside lay the bodies of the soldiers, sprawling where they had fallen, the sentries by their pillboxes, still clutching their automatic pistols, and inside the protecting wall, 2 ragged squads of soldiers in battle dress. They lay in vague, untidy heaps, some bodies athwart or on top of their neighbours. Outside, between Bullion Boulevard and the main gate, 2 armoured cars had crashed into each other and now stood locked, their heavy machine guns pointing, one at the ground and the other at the sky. A driver's body sprawled out of the turret of one of the vehicles. Desperately, Bond looked for a sign of life, a sign of movement, a hint that all this was a careful ambush. Nothing. Not a cat moved. Not a sound came out of the crowded buildings that formed a backdrop to the scene. Only the squads hurried about their tasks, or now stood waiting in their planned dispositions. Goldfinger spoke quietly into his microphone.
"Last stretcher out. Bomb squad ready. Prepare to take cover."
Now the covering troops and the stretcher-bearers were hurrying for the exit, getting down under cover of the guard wall. There would be 5 minutes' delay to clear the area before the bomb squad, now waiting bunched at the main gate, would go in. Bond said efficiently, "They're a minute ahead of time." Goldfinger looked past Oddjob's shoulder. The pale eyes were aflame. They stared into Bond's. Goldfinger's mouth twisted into a harsh snarl. He said through his teeth,
"You see, Mr. Bond, you were wrong, and I was right. 10 more minutes, and I shall be the richest man in the world. The richest man in history. What do you say to that?"
His mouth spat out the words. Bond said equably, "I'll tell you after those 10 minutes are up."
will you?"
said Goldfinger.
"Maybe."
He looked at his watch and spoke rapidly into his microphone. The Goldfinger squad loped slowly through the main gate, their heavy burden slung from four shoulders in a cradle of webbing. Goldfinger looked past Bond at the group on the roof of the second diesel. He called out triumphantly,
"Another 5 minutes, gentlemen, and then we must take cover."
He turned his eyes on Bond and added softly,
"And then we will say goodbye, Mr. Bond, and thank you for the assistance you and the girl have given me."
Out of the corner of his eye, Bond saw something moving, moving in the sky. It was a black, whirling speck. It reached the top of its trajectory, paused, and then came the ear-splitting crack of a maroon signal. Bond's heart leapt. A quick glance showed him the ranks of dead soldiers springing to life, the machine guns on the locked armoured cars swinging to cover the gates. A loudspeaker roared from nowhere,
"Stand where you are! Lay down your arms!"
But there came a futile crackle of fire from one of the rear-guard covering party, and then all hell broke loose. Bond seized the girl round the waist and jumped with her. It was a 10-foot drop to the platform. Bond broke his fall with his left hand and hoisted the girl to her feet with a jerk of his hip. As he began to run close to the train for cover, he heard Goldfinger shout,
"Get them and kill them!"
A splatter of lead from Goldfinger's automatic whipped at the cement to his left, but Goldfinger would have to shoot left-handed. It was odd job that Bond feared. Now, as Bond tore down the platform with the girl's hand in his, he heard the lightning scuffle of the running feet. The girl's hand tugged at him. She screamed angrily,
"No, no, stop! I want to stay close to Pussy. I'll be safe with her."
Bond shouted back, "Shut up, you little fool! Run like hell!" But now she was dragging at him, checking his speed. Suddenly she tore her hand out of his and made to dart into an open Pullman door. "Christ," thought Bond, "that's torn it." He whipped the knife out of his belt and swirled to meet Oddjob. 10 yards away, Oddjob hardly paused in his rush. One hand whipped off his ridiculous, deadly hat, a glance to take aim, and the black steel half-moon sang through the air. Its edge caught the girl exactly at the nape of the neck. Without a sound, she fell backwards onto the platform in Oddjob's path. The hurdle was just enough to put Oddjob off the flying high kick he had started to launch at Bond's head. He turned the kick into a leap, his left hand cutting the air towards Bond like a sword. Bond ducked and struck upwards and sideways with his knife. It got home somewhere near the ribs, but the momentum of the flying body knocked the knife out of his hand. There was a tinkle on the platform. Now Oddjob was coming back at him, apparently unharmed, his hands outstretched and his feet splayed back, ready for another leap or a kick. His blood was up. The eyes were red, and there was a fleck of saliva at the open, panting mouth. Above the boom and rattle of the guns outside the station, three blasts sounded on the diesel's windhorn. Oddjob snarled angrily and leapt. Bond dived at full length, sideways. Something hit him a gigantic blow on the shoulder and sent him sprawling. Now, he thought as he hit the ground, now the death stroke. He scrambled clumsily to his feet, his neck hunched into his shoulders to break the impact. But no blow came, and Bond's dazed eyes took in the figure of Oddjob flying away from him up the platform. Already the leading diesel was on the move. Oddjob got to it and leapt for the footplate. For a moment he hung, his legs scrabbling for a foothold. Then he had disappeared into the cabin, and the huge streamlined engine gathered speed. Behind Bond, the door of the quartermaster's office burst open. There was the hammer of running feet, and a yell, "Santiago!" St. James, the battle cry of Cortez that Leiter had once jokingly allotted to Bond. Bond swiveled. The straw-haired Texan, clad in his wartime Marine Corps battle dress, was pounding up the platform, followed by a dozen men in khaki. He carried a one-man bazooka by the steel hook he used for a right hand. Bond ran to meet him. He said,
"Don't shoot my fox, you bastard! Give over!"
He snatched the bazooka out of Leiter's hand and threw himself down on the platform, splaying out his legs. Now the diesel was 200 yards away and about to cross the bridge over the Dixie Highway. Bond shouted, "Stand clear!" to get the men out of line of the recoil flash, clicked up the safe and took careful aim. The bazooka shuddered slightly, and the 10-pound armor-piercing rocket was on its way. There was a flash and a puff of blue smoke. Some bits of metal flew off the rear of the flying engine, but then it had crossed the bridge and taken the curve and was away.
"Not bad for a rookie," commented Leiter.
May put the rear diesel out, but those jobs are twins, and he can make it on the forward engine.
Bond got to his feet. He smiled warmly into the hawk-like, slate-grey eyes.
"You bungling oaf," he said sarcastically. "Why in hell didn't you block that line?"
"Listen, Seamus, if you got any complaints about the stage management, you can tell them to the President. He took personal command of this operation, and it's a honey. There's a spotter plane overhead now. They'll pick up the diesel, and we'll have old Goldilocks in the Hoosgow by midday. How were we to know he was going to stay aboard the train?"
He broke off and thumped Bond between the shoulder blades.
"Hell, I'm glad to see you. These men and I were detailed off to give you protection. We've been dodging around looking for you and getting shot at by both sides for our pains."
He turned to the soldiers.
"Ain't that right, men?"
They laughed.
"Sure is, Captain."
Bond looked affectionately at the Texan, with whom he had shared so many adventures. He said seriously, "Bless you, Felix. You've always been good at saving my life.
It was darn nearly too late this time.
I'm afraid Tilly Masterton's had it." He walked off up the train with Felix at his heels. The little figure still lay sprawled where she had fallen. Bond knelt beside her. The broken doll angle of the head was enough. He felt for her pulse. He got up. He said softly, "Poor little bitch. She didn't think much of men." He looked defensively at Leiter. "Felix, I could have got her away if she'd only followed me." Leiter didn't understand. He put his hand on Bond's arm and said,
"Sure, kid. Take it easy."
He turned to his men.
"Two of you carry the girl into the QM's office over there. O'Brien, you go for the ambulance. When you've done that, stop over at the command post and give him the facts. Say we've got Commander Bond, and I'll bring him right over."
Bond stood and looked down at the little empty tangle of limbs and clothes. He saw the bright, proud girl with a spotted handkerchief round her hair in the flying TR-3. Now she had gone. High up over his head, a whirling speck soared into the sky. It reached the top of its flight and paused. There came the sharp crack of the maroon. It was the ceasefire.
Chapter 22. The Last Trick. It was 2 days later. Felix Leiter was weaving the black Studilac fast through the lanes of dawdling traffic on the Triborough Bridge. There was plenty of time to catch Bond's plane, the evening BOAC Monarch to London. But Leiter enjoyed shaking up Bond's low opinion of American cars. Now the steel hook that he used for a right hand banged the gear lever into second, and the low black car leapt for a narrow space between a giant refrigerator truck and a mooning Oldsmobile whose rear window was almost obscured by holiday stickers. Bond's body jerked back with a kick of the 300 brake horsepower, and his teeth snapped shut. When the manoeuvre was completed and the angry hooting had vanished behind them, Bond said mildly, "It's time you graduated out of the kiddie car class and bought yourself an express carriage. You want to get cracking. This peddling along ages one. One of these days you'll stop moving altogether, and when you stop moving is when you start to die."
Leiter laughed. He said, "See that green light ahead? Bet I can make it before it goes red."
The car leapt forward as if it had been kicked. There was a brief hiatus in Bond's life, an impression of snipe-like flight and of a steel wall of cars that somehow parted before the whiplash of Leiter's triple klaxons, 100 yards, when the speedometer touched 90 and they were across the lights and cruising genteelly along in the centre lane. Bond said calmly, "You meet the wrong traffic cop, and that Pinkerton card of yours won't be good enough. It isn't so much that you drive slowly, it's holding back the cars behind they'll book you for. The sort of car you need is a nice elderly Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost with big plate-glass windows so you can enjoy the beauties of nature." Bond gestured towards a huge automobile junk heap on their right. "Maximum 50, and it can stop and even go backwards if you want to. Bulb horn. Suit your sedate style. Matter of fact, there should be one on the market soon. Goldfinger's. And by the same token, what the hell's happened to Goldfinger? Haven't they caught up with him yet?" Leiter glanced at his watch and edged into the outside lane. He brought the car down to 40. He said seriously,
"Tell you the truth, we're all a bit worried. The papers are needling us, or rather, Edgar Hoover's crowd, like hell. First they had a gripe at the security clamp down on you. We couldn't tell them that wasn't our fault, and that someone in London, an old limey called M, had insisted on it. So they're getting their own back, say we're dragging our feet and so forth. And I'm telling you, James..."
Leiter's voice was glum, apologetic.
"We just haven't a clue. They caught up with a diesel. Goldfinger had fixed the controls at 30 and had let it run on down the line. Somewhere he and the Korean had got off, and probably this Galore girl, and the four hoods as well, because they vanished too. We found his truck convoy, of course, waiting on the eastbound highway out of Elizabethville, but never a driver, most probably scattered. But somewhere there's Goldfinger and a pretty tough team hiding up. They didn't get to the Sverdlovsk cruiser at Norfolk. We had a plainclothes guard scattered around the docks, and they report that she sailed to schedule without any strangers going aboard. Not a cat's been near that warehouse on East River, and no one's shown at Idlewild or the frontiers, Mexico and Canada. For my money, that Jed Midnight has somehow got them out to Cuba. If they'd taken two or three trucks from the convoy and driven like hell, they could have got down to Florida, somewhere like Daytona Beach, by the early hours of D+1. And Midnight's darn well organized down there. The Coast Guards and the Air Force have put out all they've got, but nothing's shown yet. But they could have hidden up during the day and got over to Cuba during the night. It's got everybody worried as hell, and it's no help that the President's hopping mad. Bond had spent the previous day in Washington treading the thickest, richest red carpet. There had been speeches at the Bureau of the Mint, a big brass lunch at the Pentagon, an embarrassing quarter of an hour with the President, and the rest of the day had been hard work with a team of stenographers in Edgar Hoover's suite of offices, with a colleague of Bond's from Station A sitting in. At the end of that, there had been a brisk quarter of an hour's talk with M on the embassy transatlantic scrambler. M had told him what had been happening on the European end of the case. As Bond had expected, Goldfinger's cable to Universal Export had been treated as emergency. The factories at Recalva and Coppet had been searched, and extra evidence of the gold smuggling racket had been found. The Indian government had been warned about the Mecca plane that was already en route for Bombay, and that end of the operation was on the way to being cleaned up. The Swiss Special Brigade had quickly found Bond's car and had got onto the route by which Bond and the girl had been taken to America. But there, at Idlewild, the FBI had lost the scent. M seemed pleased with the way Bond had handled Operation Grand Slam, but he said the Bank of England were worrying him about Goldfinger's £20 million in gold. Goldfinger had assembled all this at the Paragon Safe Deposit Company in New York, but had withdrawn it on D-1. He and his men had driven it away in a covered truck. The Bank of England had ready an order in council to impound the gold when it was found, and there would then be a case to prove that it had been smuggled out of England, or at least that it was originally smuggled gold whose value had been increased by various doubtful means. But this was now being handled by the U.S. Treasury and the FBI, and since M had no jurisdiction in America, Bond had better come home at once and help tidy things up. Oh, yes. At the end of the conversation, M's voice had sounded gruff. There had been a very kind request to the PM that Bond should be allowed to accept the American Medal of Merit. Of course, M had had to explain via the PM that the service didn't go in for those sort of things, particularly from foreign countries, however friendly they were. Too bad. But M knew that this was what Bond would have expected. He knew the rules. Bond had said, yes, of course, and thank you very much, and he'd take the next plane home. Now, as they motored quietly down the Van Wyck Expressway, Bond was feeling vaguely dissatisfied. He didn't like leaving ragged ends to a case. None of the big gangsters had been put in the bag, and he had failed in the two tasks he had been given, to get Goldfinger and get Goldfinger's bullion. It was nothing but a miracle that Operation Grand Slam had been broken. It had been 2 days before the beach craft had been serviced, and the cleaner who found the note had got to Pinkerton's only half an hour before Leiter was due to go off to the coast on a big racing scandal. But then Leiter had really got cracking, to his chief, then to the FBI and the Pentagon. The FBI's knowledge of Bond's record, plus contact with M through the Central Intelligence Agency, had been enough to get the whole case up to the President within an hour. After that, it had just been a case of building up the gigantic bluff in which all the inhabitants of Fort Knox had participated in one way or another. The two Japanese had been taken easily enough, and it was confirmed by chemical warfare that the 3 pints of GB carried as gin in their briefcases would have been enough to slay the entire population of Fort Knox. The two men had been quickly and forcibly grilled into explaining the form of the all-clear cable to Goldfinger. The cable had been sent. Then the army had declared emergency. Road and rail and air blocks had turned back all traffic to the Fort Knox area, with the exception of the gangster convoys, which had not been hindered. The rest was play-acting, right down to the pink froth and the squalling babies, which it was thought would add nice touches of verisimilitude.
Yes, it had all been very satisfactory, so far as Washington was concerned. But what about the English end? Who in America cared about the Bank of England's gold? Who cared that two English girls had been murdered in the course of this business? Who really minded that Goldfinger was still at liberty now that America's bullion was safe again? They idled across the drab plain of Idlewild, past the $10 million steel and cement skeletons that would one day be an adult airport, and pulled up outside the makeshift huddle of concrete boxes that Bond knew so well. This book is continued on Disc 8.